pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views, and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business, and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, listeners, to episode 23 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. That was Scott the Velvet Glove giving the introduction, and he's here in person tonight. Welcome back, Velvet Glove, from your travels overseas.
G'day, g'day, g'day. How are you all? I had a great time abroad, but I'm glad to be back home too. So, yeah.
Very good. We are setting the standard when it comes to holidays in this podcast.
We are.
Velvet Glove. I've been on a few. Now you've been on one. If that's not an advertisement for secularism, I don't know what is.
Yeah, I agree. But, no, it was a good holiday, but I'm glad I'm home now. Mm.
So I thought we would kick off with this article, which... was printed in the London Times, but it is relevant. And it was only printed 29th of November. And, I mean, you could not believe that somebody could say such a thing in such a publication as the London Times, of all things. So,
well, when I first read it, I thought to myself, my God, this is just this is something that they might get away with in... you know, where I've just visited.
Yes.
But no.
Yeah. So I'll just read it for people so that they can hear how scathing and vitriolic this is. So this columnist, Giles Corran, says, "God, I hate Jews. I don't think there can be a group of people on earth more convinced of their own rightness, more dismissive of other people's interests and beliefs, or more dogmatic and humorless about their own massively unappealing and totally irrelevant Weltanschauung than the I Believe in Yahweh squad." And that German word means worldview. And he continued, "But it's not the nihilism, the soullessness, the lack of poetry, the moral and physical ugliness, the shallow iconoclasm, or the vainglory of Jews that bothers me most. It's the boringness." Now, so listeners, that's pretty rough language, and you would think, how did that possibly get printed? And the trick to all this is that he didn't actually say that about Jews. He said that about atheists.
Really?
Yes. And if he'd said it about Jews, he wouldn't be able to get away with that, would he?
No, of course not. He would have been slapped down for sure.
Yeah. So bit of a double standard happens there, where you know, atheists can come in for a bagging. And last week, Velvet Glove, in your absence, we were talking about Malcolm Turnbull in Parliament referred to the godless ISIS murderers.
And, yes. Yeah, I remember that.
I was making the point that they're very godly, not godless, and the 12th man made the point that, you know, godless was used in a very derogatory fashion.
Yeah.
So anyway, watch out for that in your readings, that it's okay to refer to one group of people in such a slanderous way, yet the test on all these things is, you know, if you took the name of one group and replaced it with another group, or say black people or Jews, you know, would it suddenly become unacceptable? And if it fails that test, then it's something you shouldn't be saying. So Giles Corran thinks that atheists are convinced of their own rightness, dismissive of interests, blah, 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 but terrible things to say. So that's our lead-off item. And Velvet Glove, keep going.
I just find it somewhat bizarre that he said, you know, where was it? He said it's not the lack of poetry, the physical ugliness, the shallow iconoclasm, the vainglory of atheists that bother me most is its boringness. I mean, I don't know why they would think that atheists are boring people.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
Clearly he hasn't listened to this podcast.
No, evidently not.
But what we're going to do, try and spice up the podcast and make sure it's not boring, Velvet Glove, is I've got a great little quiz that I'm just going to run through at different times. Little questions for you.
Well,
and, and to test you after perhaps after each article. So we'll start with this first one. So question for you. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. If you are unhappy with your children's behaviour, do you A, discipline them sternly but gently and coach them to become better behaved, B, kick them in the teeth, or C, drown them?
Well, if we, this is from the Bible, is it, or is this from?
I want your answer. I want your answer.
Okay. Well, my answer would be A. Then yes, if I had children, I'd be firm but fair with them.
If you're a Bible enthusiast, you're wrong. It would be C. You would drown them. Genesis 6:7. Okay.
Yes, well, you know.
We'll continue in that vein as we go through the podcast.
Right, okay.
And listeners at home, you know, just keep your own score with your own answers and see how you go. Now, I should have asked you this beforehand in case you're revealing something personal here, Velvet Glove. Alcoholics Anonymous, ever been?
No, never been.
But if you had a problem with alcohol and you're thinking, I really need to do something about this, what would be kind of the first group in your mind that you might think of Googling and turning to?
It probably would be AA.
Yeah, Alcoholics Anonymous. So so they are, you know, synonymous with helping people deal with alcohol problems.
Gambling and all the other problems too.
Yeah, but despite my radar for all things religious, I was not aware of how religious the Alcoholics Anonymous program is. Were you?
I was aware that it was religious, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit religious, but...
Yeah.
So I've got a link to an article where this guy, you know, basically went to Alcoholics Anonymous and gave his experience, and that caused me to then go to their website. This is the Australian version.
Yeah.
And there's basically 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
Basically, these are the 12 steps to follow as part of the program. So, what you've got to do is, let me just get the terminology right here. The heart of the suggested program of personal recovery is contained in 12 steps describing the experience of the earliest members of the society. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Like, that's 1 to 7. I won't go through till number 12, but my goodness me, what an admission of just bowing down to God and wanting him to sort of take over the problem for you.
Exactly. You know, I didn't really... I knew that there was a faith base to it. I had no idea the whole thing was 12 steps to walk in the warm light of Jesus. But it's amazing, isn't it?
It's extremely religious, the 12 steps. And in this article, no surprise to learn that various psychiatrists are now saying that such a program is not very effective at all and is effective for as few as 5 to 8% of people. And that other programs, you know, have like a 78% success rate. So, so if I or a friend have an alcohol problem, I think that I'd be steering clear of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was founded off the back of a 1930s Christian revivalist movement, and the doctrine hasn't changed since that time.
Is that right?
So Alcoholics Anonymous, far more religious than I would have thought.
Yeah, it's funny in the article. I mean, you do go down there. There's a point he says, I don't regret joining AA, but 14 years of it, I now believe may have been unnecessary. You know, it's an interesting one because the guy clearly, well, I mean, I don't know how big a drinker he was, but clearly he was a drunk, and he had to get sober somehow, and he got sober with AA. But interesting one anyway.
Another quiz for you, Velvet Glove.
Oh God, okay.
If a group of children are teasing a bald man, do you A, gently reprimand the children and ask them to apologise? B, punch them in the face? Or C, set wild boars upon them?
Okay, well, again, I would be answering A, but I'm assuming that's wrong, and I'd probably be required to set wild boars upon them, would I?
Correct. Kings, yes. 2:23 and 24. And we'll throw in one more here. If your children are hungry for more than tiny biscuits and ask you for food, do you A, feed them, B, laugh at them, C, feed them and then kill them by deliberately infecting them with a deadly disease?
Okay, probably A, but still in all again because this is the Bible. I'm assuming it's C. Yeah.
Bonus points if you can at least name the book from the Bible that the Bible answer comes from. You know, you just we've had Genesis, we've had Kings. This one was from Numbers 11.
Numbers.
31 to 35. So. Personally, I find Deuteronomy is full of Leviticus is full of a lot of stuff. If you in the future ones, I would have a guess at Leviticus for bonus points. But all part of the Bible nonsense that we like to indoctrinate our children with. So it's just good to know what the kiddies are learning at their special religious instruction class.
Agreed. Mm. Yeah.
So next on the agenda is we've had this abortion clinic murder.
Yeah, in Colorado, wasn't it?
Yes, one of the American states. What do you make of that one?
Look, I mean, it doesn't surprise me. You know, you've got this morning on... I was listening to Radio National this morning and they were talking about God and guns and that sort of stuff. Mm. And it doesn't surprise me that an abortion clinic has been targeted.
Mm. Well, not for the first time. Happens fairly regularly over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess what we need to look at is, you know, this to me seems to be a sort of right-wing extremist section of the Christian movement that is conducting terrorist activities, I mean, on American soil. I mean, there are groups. Yeah. This isn't the only one, and... You know, the nature of these actions is a ideologically motivated one. It's to it's not just a random killing. It is done as a point of dissuading others from conducting certain activities. So, you know, when we jump all over Islam and we say, well, sure, you might be moderate, but you've got these texts that say things and you've got a large number of people who condone activities and then people take that and take it to another level. I think the Christian right is got something to answer for here because...
Absolutely, they really do.
They have, you know, in America they are just the hatred and bile that they spew out as part of the right to life advocates within the Christian right-wing movement. The language they use, they make up stuff, they incite hatred towards abortion clinics and the people in them. And so they are culpable in the same way that Islam is culpable when it incites people and they take it to that extra step and actually go and kill people. So,
yeah.
So terrorism is, you know, it's... It's a very similar sort of thing that's just happened, except it's a form of Christian terrorism.
Yeah, agreed. And, you know, the article that you're pointing to makes that point in the opening paragraph. It talks about, you know, the jihadist threat was a tremendous one, pointing to Al-Qaeda's attacks on September 11, 2001. But you then look at that and... Where was it? No, I've lost it. But there was a point that was made in this exact article that the numbers of people that have died at the hands of Islamic terrorists is nothing compared to the numbers that have died at the hands of Christian terrorists.
Yep. So from April 2009 to February 2015, so a six-year period in the United States, you know, almost the last 6 years, more people have died in America from non-Islamic domestic terrorists than they have from jihadists.
Yeah.
So it's quite prevalent in there. And this article goes on to say, you know, Muslims don't have a market, the market cornered on religious extremism. And it lists a few different Christian right-wing terrorist groups that are known for their violence and fanaticism. And the thing that got me about these groups, Velvet Glove, was just the names. And I'll run through them. Number one, the Army of God, which promotes killing abortion providers and also has a history of violence against gays. So that's the Army of God. Then there's Eastern Lightning, which is in China, and they're an apocalypse-focused group whose duty is to slay as many demons as possible. The third one is called the Lord's Resistance Army, LRA. In Uganda, they're committing as many atrocities as Boko Haram and not getting nearly the publicity, so they've got to work on their publicity, but they are a right-wing Christian group that are kidnapping and killing people left, right and centre. Another one, the National Liberation Front of Tripura. it's like something out of a Monty Python Life of Brian sketch.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
They're in India. Most Indian Christians are peaceful, but these guys are a major exception, and they're running around with zero tolerance for any religion other than Christianity. And, for example, in 2003, they killed 30 Hindus. There's the Phineist Priesthood, which is a white supremacist, sort of a Ku Klux Klan type group. Again, activities ranging from abortion clinic bombings to bank robberies. And the final one they mentioned was the Concerned Christians. And in 1998, 60 of them went missing and 14 of them were subsequently found in Jerusalem and were deported for plotting terrorist attacks against Muslims. So there's a handful of crazy right-wing Christian groups that are out there conducting all sorts of crazy stuff. And so there we go. We like to pick on all religions, not just Islam, and we'll call them out when they do it.
No.
You didn't run into any of those in your recent trip in America?
No, I didn't actually. No, I didn't run into any particular religious organisations or religious groups.
See, you spent a fair bit of time in San Francisco, and the thing about the States is, like, there's several different countries within the one there. Like, the people in California and San Francisco would be very different to Alabama. Like, it could be completely different countries.
Yeah, they're for sure. And, you know, I mean, it is very different from when I was last there, because when I was last there, that's a few years ago now, but I was in the southern states in Florida, and it was good. But this is the first time I've been on the West Coast, other than flying in, landing, getting on another plane, you know. But, yeah, it was good.
Yep. Now, this quiz that I am giving you, Scott, is... I've subscribed to a thing called Atheist Republic. Have you heard of that on the internet, Atheist Republic?
No, I actually haven't. No.
Yeah, I've come across it, I think, via the 12th Man with his Facebook posts and eventually onto their website. And they produce a free little book you can get on PDF. And it's got this article where this guy is basically examining God and as against some common psychiatric tests to see whether gods, you know, psychotic enough or not.
Yeah.
And that's where some of those questions came from. And so it's "Dear God, You Must Be Psychotic" by Michael Sherlock. So that's where those ones came from. And as part of that, he sort of moves on to a different area of psychology. And he says, the question is, if you are the all-powerful, all-loving, and all-knowing creator of everything, and you desire a cosmos which is absent of evil, do you A, create a cosmos without evil, or B, create a cosmos with evil? And he said God chose B, clearly. If you have two newborn children who do not know the difference between right and wrong, do you A, leave them alone in a garden without constant supervision, and also plant a tree that they are not allowed to eat from, along with the most cunning beast of the field, a walking and talking snake, who you know will persuade them to eat from that tree, or B, look after them? And we know which one he chose.
Yeah, we know which one he chose.
Yeah, so I quite enjoyed reading that article, and more of that to come. Next up, we've got... have you come across the Virgin Mary lately? Any apparitions?
No, I haven't actually seen the Virgin Mary, no. But I was very interested when you sent the article, you know, about the number of places that the Virgin Mary had actually been seen. And, well, surprisingly, yeah, it's in the most Catholic of areas.
Yes. Perhaps the non-Catholics don't recognise the Virgin Mary when she,
well,
when she pops up.
The thing, well, this is the other thing that I heard the other morning on Radio National was there was a discussion about the Virgin Mary, and they were saying, isn't it amazing she's never been seen in Israel or Egypt or anywhere like that, you know?
Oh, hang on. Well, I know. Well, dear listener, I've got an article with a link, and... there's an article coming out in National Geographic,
yes,
on the significance and legacy of the Virgin Mary, and in that is a link to a website called miraclehunter.com, which chronicles all of the sightings of the Virgin Mary as if she's a Bigfoot. And it's done in a map format, so... you can click on it and you see a map of the world with these little dots all over it where the Virgin Mary has been sighted. And look, I'm surprised you haven't seen the Virgin Mary, because by the looks of this map, we'd be tripping over her every 5 minutes. Although, to be frank, Australia has performed poorly on that map. So we need to keep looking more, or else she's just ignoring us here. But
well, I mean, it's quite possible she's just ignoring us too.
Yeah, but there's an extraordinary number of sightings of the Virgin Mary, particularly in the Catholic parts of the world, and a lot in America, and a lot in recent times. So if you're wondering, if you're on the lookout for the Virgin Mary and you'd like to see her, perhaps go to that map and you could have a fair chance. Well, that'll improve your chances if you consult the map, I think.
Well, you know, I mean, it's always an option, so it's an option for sure.
Mm. Syria, Scott.
Yes.
Yes, in your absence, our new Prime Minister said that we would not be sending more troops to Syria.
Yeah, and that was something that was reasonable. I think it was a nice thing that he actually said.
Mm. I was happy about that.
Yes.
So, found a great article from The Guardian, again on the website, which the reason I think it's great, Scott, is because it agrees with all the things I've been saying lately. But basically, this reporter who spent a lot of time in that part of the world, basically saying that, you know, the problem is ISIS is embedded in these cities, surrounded now by civilian houses. Like, they move from house to house regularly. In a place like Mosul, there's 1.5 million people and maybe 15,000 ISIS terrorists. They're moving in and out, living within the community. You can't bomb them out. If you were to try and remove them through bombing, you would have to level the entire city. It just doesn't work that way when you've got people who are sort of embedded in amongst a civilian population.
Well, that's the thing that I thought right from word go when the whole thing got out of control and we started to see when they announced that we were sending, what was it, 6 Super Hornet jets and that sort of stuff. So we committed 6 Super Hornet jets to the area. I thought to myself, this isn't going to work.
The best they can do with a bomb is if they can identify a truckload of terrorists perhaps moving from one city to another and, do a drone strike and knock them off. But that doesn't happen all that often. It's hard to get that intelligence and that's a mere scratch of the surface of the problem. So it's just crazy. Like, you can't blame... you can understand France is angry and, retaliates and goes out and drops some bombs, but some smarter thinking's required, because all you're doing there is creating civilian casualties and bomb from France or the America lands on a hospital or just an ordinary home, kills somebody's children. What are they going to do? They're going to
use that to recruit more terrorists.
Exactly. You're going to go, God damn those Frenchmen, I'm going to become a terrorist now and kill them because they've killed my family. Yeah. It just doesn't win you any friends dropping bombs unless you've got a town that's 100% full of ISIS terrorists, and that isn't happening. Yeah. So this article said 3 things to do. That need to be done. First, America has to stop Gulf states from delivering weapons to the terrorists in Syria and Iraq. Well, that doesn't...
Agreed.
Control the borders in and stop arms getting in. Like, that would be common sense. Are we doing it? No.
No, we're not.
Second, the West has to help Turkey seal its border with Islamic State to stop new fighters getting in. Great idea. Patrol the border and stop people crossing over and getting in.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to send Australians to do that sort of role. Like, border protection. We're good at that. That's one of our... That's a skill we can export, Scott.
Agreed, yeah.
Thirdly... ISIS can only exist because it has managed to ally itself with the suppressed Sunni populations of Iraq and Syria.
Yeah.
So what you've got to do is have a reconciliation in Iraq and Syria that integrates the Sunnis into political life.
Yeah, agreed.
These are the obvious things to do. I really like the one of stopping the delivery of weapons and armaments into the area. I mean, when they run out of ammunition and they're throwing rocks, then the local population's got a chance.
Yeah, agree.
I think I heard a rumour of something. Because, ISIS has got control of these oil fields and they've got lots of money to buy stuff. Who do they export the oil to? Who's buying this? How does that
this
happen?
This is a question that I don't understand, is who's buying the oil?
I heard this thing, which I think I caught a bit of it in the news or in something, to suggest it was Turkey was buying the oil. But
is that right?
So, it shouldn't matter that ISIS has got control of oil fields because they shouldn't be allowed to move the oil out and sell it.
Yeah.
And money shouldn't be allowed to come in and armaments shouldn't be allowed to come in. So sealing the border would be a great idea, and that's something we should support, and nobody seems to talk about it.
No, it's madness, actually, by, the way the whole war's being fought is, it's just being fought entirely wrong.
Mm.
It's bizarre.
Yep. Meanwhile, Tony Abbott wants us, sort of...
He wants to send us troops, doesn't
he? Yeah, he's sort of barking away in the background of the backbenches there and saying we should be sending troops and...
Yeah, he's bloody idiot.
Yes. figured that
seriously.
Out.
Yeah, no, but seriously, you don't send troops into an area like that. It's madness. Mm.
So before I move on to the next one, Velvet Glove, should your children eat pork?
Yes, they should.
Well, trick question. Leviticus 11:7 Leviticus says no, but Mark 7:18 says yes.
Yes.
Must your children rest on the Sabbath?
Yes, they're supposed to.
Exodus says yes, but Matthew 12 and Mark 2 say no.
Is that right? Mm.
Must your children be circumcised? I mean, this is pretty simple. This is simple. Like, surely on such a simple matter of circumcision, the Bible would be clear on this.
Well, the Bible's not actually clear on circumcision. I think it's there's two places. Well, Leviticus says, yes, you should. And then later on in the New Testament, it says, no, it's not compulsory.
I've got here, you might be right about Leviticus. I'd quote it on pretty much anything. But I've got here, Genesis 17 says yes, and Romans 4 says no.
Oh, dear. It's very funny.
Yeah. Now, I wonder, we in the secular party in Brisbane, we've got a member who is a pastafarian. Mm-hmm. And do you think pastafarians are well known in the general community, Scott?
I think they are now. Well, no, they are becoming better known. Certainly people these days, if you say, yeah, I'm a pastafarian, they sort of look at you, they look initially, then enough that they've then it then clicks as to what they are.
Yeah, yeah. I think most people do. And in the States, and now in Victoria, pastafarians are starting to a bit of a movement in terms of their driver's license photos. So in the pastafarian movement, well, to explain to people who may not know, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, or Pastafarianism, it's a religion, and some people say it's a parody of a religion, and others say that it's a legitimate religion. And it was started by a guy called Bobby Henderson in 2005, who was protesting at the Kansas State Board of Education decision to permit teaching intelligent design as an alternative to evolution. So he wrote a letter, and from that sprung up the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. And the adherence to the church as part of their religious ideology have certain headwear that they like to wear, and that is a colander, which they put on their head. And pastafarians around the world are starting to insist on having their driver's license photo being taken with a spaghetti strainer / colander on their head. And there was a guy in Victoria just recently, there's an article here on the website, a Melbourne man who, Benjamin Addy, he insisted that when he went to Victorian Roads that his driver's license photo be taken with his religious headwear on. And initially, he was denied the right to do that. And he says here, I have to tell you, I felt very much discriminated against. I had to really go and bat for my religious rights. The matter was referred to a manager who told him she wasn't allowed to discuss his religion with him. And he said, I asked her if a Sikh or Muslim person came in and the person taking the photo said to them, take off your religious headgear. Would you take the same tact with them as you have with me? Good point, Mr. Addy. The manager ended up letting him get the photo, but told him it was likely to be rejected. And it says here, he said he only wore the colander to formal occasions.
Yeah, I mean, I read the article too, and there's not a lot there. It's just, you know, the guy's just poking fun at religion, really, by insisting that he should be able to wear the colander.
Yes.
But having said all that, you know, it's, hey, you know, it's his right. And, you know, it's a stupid thing, but hey, that's it.
Yeah. It's just a great example of the stupidity of some of the notions of religious groups that pastafarianism points out. And so I went onto their website to just check a few things, and they make a really good point here to say that we believe religion, say Christianity, Islam, Pastafarianism, does not require literal belief in order to provide spiritual enlightenment. Much of the transcendent experience of religion can be attributed to the community. And while some members of religion are indoctrinated true believers, many are not. There are many levels of belief, and each is no more or less legitimate than the other. That is to say, you do not have to believe to be part of our church, but we hope in time you will see the truth. So it's actually quite a good point that lots of people are members of religion who actually don't really believe in all of the stuff, but they just quite like the community social aspect of it. And yeah. As a Pastafarian, you don't necessarily have to believe in the flying spaghetti monster, but you just believe in the community that you have.
Hmm.
So I thought that was good. And some of the other things that they believe in, they believe that Pastafarians evolved from pirates, and that pirates were originally peaceful explorers. It was only due to Christian misinformation that they have an image of outcast criminals today. No one knows what the afterlife really holds, but we are told FSM heaven has a beer volcano and a stripper factory. So that's part of their belief system. The stripper factory, I mean, is that any different to Islam? How many virgins do you get in paradise?
They get 72 virgins in paradise if they die for the cause.
Yeah, that sounds like a stripper factory as well, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, yeah, but one wouldn't... I don't understand why the hell you reward people with virgins. I mean, surely you reward people with, you know, bi-curious, disease-free prostitutes, wouldn't you? No, ladies that know what they're doing.
Well...
Yeah, we'll see whether or not we cop any abuse over that.
Actually, we did get a bit of abuse for the first time.
Yes, I did notice.
Yes,
that.
Yes. Somebody wrote a comment, and good on them. Said that because we made, well, you didn't, because you missed our Islam sort of rants that the 12th man and I had over the last 2 weeks, and
yes.
About refugees. Really, I think was the gist of the person's complaint about us as being, I think, selfish and uncaring, kind of along those lines. So there you go. Despite all the abuse I've hurled at all the religions, I guess that was a refugee-related one. So anyway, at least somebody is out there listening and giving the two cents worth.
Agreed, yeah. Yeah.
So another... we had the circumcision... Do you endorse wisdom?
Well, yes, I do.
Well, Proverbs, yes. Corinthians, no. Will you protect the righteous?
Well, yes.
Proverbs, yes. Hebrews, no. this is to God. Are you a God of peace? And he would... John, yes, and Exodus, no. Oh, for goodness sake, it's just the contradictions in that. You know, the thing that gets me about Christianity is the idea that they can get away with relying on the Bible so much. Like, if I...
Yes.
I would have thought... If you said to me in the year, I don't know, 300, that, you know, Christianity will survive and be flourishing... Given sort of modern day knowledge, I would have said, well, they probably somewhere along the way dropped the Bible and used other notions of God and paradise and probably tried to remove themselves from the Bible as much as possible.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I find incredible about the whole religious thing is that it uses itself as proof. And that's the part that I find incredibly annoying, is that it says, you know, this is it because the Bible says so. Well, no, that's not it because the Bible said so. It should be it because this is so, you know. It's just absurd. It really is.
How do you know the Bible is the Word of God? Because the Bible says it is the Word
of
God.
Yeah, exactly. It's a joke.
So,
it's an absolute joke.
It's just a horrendous document. And just the part that surprises me is they actually rely and promote the Bible. And just my common sense is that would be you'd be steering away from that and pointing to other things and other stories and creating other ideas and try and talk less about the Bible, because at some stage people are going to read it and find all this sort of nonsense that we're just doing in our quiz here. So it's a remarkable exercise in salesmanship.
Yeah, agreed.
So I've got another article here on the Royal Commission into institutional child abuse, and it makes the point about how George Pell is going to be coming up for attention over the next few weeks in the questioning. And the commission's in Melbourne. And in here it says, over the past 35 years, 454 people have made claims or complaints about child sexual abuse by priests. And, you know, it says, you know, this is going on all over the world. But what sets Melbourne apart from cities in Europe and America is how little the church has had to pay.
Yeah, and it's bloody disgraceful, isn't it?
It is. So in somewhere like Chicago, each abuse claim has cost the church about $1 million. In Melbourne, the average is $46,000. And largely, it seems, because of George Pell.
It's no wonder that the man's been made treasury of the entire church, isn't it?
Exactly. With that sort of frugality, it is no wonder that he's been put in charge of the church finances.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a phenomenal bloody number, because, you know, well, what is it, 454 people made claims or substantiated complaints about child sexual abuse by priests, religious employees or volunteers. Now, if that was in Chicago, that'd be 454 million.
Yes. Actually, I might have... I might have cut that short. I said 454 by priests, but you're right. It's by priests, against priests, is 335. And and the other 100-odd religious employees and volunteers. Thank you for that. Yep.
No, that's quite all right. Let's just say that 335 would get the full 1 million. And then the remaining... what would that be, 119, would end up getting, say, half a million. That's still substantially more than the 18 million, which is the whole thing's cost.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bloody outrage, really.
You know, the victims were done over in more than one way, weren't they?
They really were. They really were done over very badly.
So hopefully when this report comes out, it will be the kickstart of some reforms in this community about how, you know, the privilege we're giving religion in so many ways.
Yeah, agreed.
So one of the other lines that we've been running over the last months has been, you know...
Oh, you didn't give me... Are you out of questions?
Oh, hang on. Sorry, you're right. Oh, here we go. This would be the question to God as part of the sort of psychiatry sort of questionnaire was, are you one God or many?
Well, I don't know.
Genesis 1 would say many, but Genesis 2 would say one. So,
yes. Right.
And God, will you preserve the earth?
Well, actually, no, I flooded it once, so...
Well, Ecclesiastes, yes, and Peter, no.
Okay, so, right.
so that's the quiz. We'll move on to the next one. But the 12th man loved the quiz. He was very good on percentages of population-type questions. You know,
yes.
Essential Report should just stop interviewing people and just take... the 12th man out to lunch and ask him the questions, because he was very close on a lot of those. So we can... he's in touch with the community, the 12th man.
Is that right? Okay.
Now, I've got...
good to know.
One of our things I've been saying is, if only we had religious education classes in schools so that all the kiddies could learn about all the different religions, warts and all view of it, and yep. that would help reduce radicalisation as mm-hmm. people understand things better. And if yeah. kids are going to school with each other rather than in separate religious schools, they'll get to know each other and become friends and less likely to kill each other.
Agreed.
So, link to an article. Religious studies in schools can play a vital role in countering violent extremism from November 20th. And that's from a couple of people from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Now, I don't know. Have you ever heard of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute?
No, only when I read the article earlier today.
This is the thing about these think tanks. Like, who are these groups? I didn't have time to look up myself, Scott. But, you know, who are they? Who's funding them? What are they? Like, you need to know. I'm spruiking this article because it happens to agree with me.
But, yeah.
So... If it disagreed with me, the first thing I'd be doing is then Googling Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Who are they? You know, are they some right-wing think tank funded by religious groups? Which is quite possible.
Mm.
So while I've... Here I am quoting an article. You've got to know who these people are behind them, haven't you? So look, don't trust that idea, folks, until we find out who the Australian Strategic Policy Institute is. Who pays them? Because these are the vital questions. I was just reading some article in the Courier Mail yesterday or today. It was going on about how a varied offerings of different schools, private schools, provided an overall better education experience, and that competition was good in the education sphere, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, that's not right. And... then when I looked, you know, the person was employed by the Australian Catholic University. Well, okay, yeah. That explains why they think that way. So with all these things, I've actually reached the point, I think, Velvet Glove, where I kind of look at the headline and then I'm going straight to the author and then deciding whether I'm going to read the stuff in the middle. You've got to.
Yeah, that's a reasonable sort of... That's a reasonable point to take.
You've got to. Now... the Church of England. Oh, have I got another quiz question? Or did I? Have I done that one? Will you preserve the earth? I had that one. Oh, here's a good quiz question. Should your children kill each other?
Well, no, they shouldn't.
I was going to say you're a follower of Exodus then.
Oh, okay.
Well, you are, Exodus 20, but read on to Exodus 32, and the answer is yes, they should.
Oh dear!
That's it for the. I've run out of quiz questions.
Questions.
Okay, you can relax now. the Church of England is angry.
Oh really? What's got them angry?
Well, in the UK, when you go to the cinema and you're about to sit down and watch a movie, do you like the idea of being subjected to some religious advertising just before you watch the latest version of Star Wars?
Well, I like being subjected to advertising anyway when I've already paid to see the bloody thing. But
yeah.
Anyway,
so, you know, if there was one cinema that, you know, offered sort of religious advertising before the movie and another one that didn't, you know, would you choose one over the other?
I'd choose the one that didn't. Mm.
So what's happened in the UK is that there is a group that is responsible for... handling advertisements for many of the cinema chains in the UK, and they mm-hmm. have a policy against running any sort of religious or political ads before films.
Yeah.
Basically, because they don't want to offend paying customers just before they settle in for a movie. That seems to me like a pretty good reason. good business model. Anyway, the Church of England proposed a one-minute ad on the benefits of prayer, and the digital cinema people said, no, you're not going to run that ad, forget it. And Church of England, of course, up in arms. The Reverend Aaron Arora said, "We find that really astonishing, disappointing, and rather bewildering." He added, "In one way, the decision of the cinemas is just plain silly, but the fact they have insisted upon it makes it rather chilling in terms of limiting free speech."
Yeah, I find this, you know, this, it's more predictably pronounced in America, where you have religious freedom and that sort of stuff that comes into it. When you have different organisations that are talking about freedom of speech, freedom of so-and-so, blah, 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 it's just getting really ugly. Mm. You know, it really is very ugly and particularly a religious organisation describing something as a freedom of speech issue. That's just disturbing.
Yeah. So I don't have any problem with the cinema doing that in the sense that they ban all religious advertisements. So if, for example, they were allowing Buddhists to advertise but not the Church of England, then that would be discrimination and can't do it. So the fact is, they said, we don't want any religious advertising at all, I think makes it a very fair thing to do. And
it's
a bit like the sort of the bakery and the wedding cake thing. Like, if you don't want to produce wedding cakes for gay people, then just don't make wedding cakes at all. That's okay.
Yeah.
But if you're going to pick and choose amongst people, that's when you've got a problem. So full marks to the cinema group there for saying no. Like, it makes sense to me, and there shouldn't be anything wrong with that.
Yeah, agreed. That's exactly.
And
right.
That'll be an argument that ends up in Australia at some stage.
Of course it will. Yeah.
Now here's a tricky one, Scott. And this one, I struggled a bit to get my thoughts together on this one.
Okay.
Australian Muslim soldier was labelled a security risk and told he would never be promoted. I don't think I've warned you about this one. Did you hear about it?
No, you haven't. No, you haven't, and I haven't heard about it.
Okay.
So
you're fresh to this. So he's an Australian soldier. He's, in fact, a drone pilot from the 20th Surveillance and Target Acquisition Regiment. He spent 8 months in Afghanistan in 2011. His story is that he enlisted in the army. Well, it's not his story, his sort of bio, is that he enlisted in the army after the September 11th terrorism attacks in 2001. So that motivated him to join the army. And 8 months later, he married an Indonesian woman and converted to Islam. So he has said that he's experienced discrimination repeatedly during his 13-year career, much of it perpetrated by senior army members. And one thing here is, last year, he asked to work flexible hours during Ramadan. When his request was refused, he approached an army chaplain for advice. He said the chaplain suggested he find another job if he wanted to practice Islam properly. I said, "Are you serious?" And he said, "Yes." So he's alleged sort of other discrimination instances there, but just focusing on last year, he asked to work flexible hours during Ramadan.
Yeah.
I've got a problem.
Well, I find it bizarre that anyone would think that they could put their hours different for a period of, what is it, a month or something like that during Ramadan?
Yeah. When it's a matter of choice. Like,
it's
his choice to take up this bunch of ideas. It's not forced on him through circumstance. It's his decision to adopt this ideology. And I think, God, it'd be, if you're trying to run an organisation like the army and, you know, he's a drone pilot, like, what happens, you know, he's flying a drone and, you know, the situation we talked about beforehand, there's a bunch of ISIS terrorists along a road going from one city to another, and oops, it's time for me to pray, I've got to leave now, can somebody else take over? Or like,
yeah, exactly. It's just a nonsense, you know. That's why that you know, when the Yom Kippur War started, it started during Yom Kippur,
right?
you know, because it was the time that the Jews were all fasting and that sort of mm-hmm. stuff. You know, it was ridiculous. Mm. It's absolutely ridiculous. Mm.
So I tried to think of some analogies to get my idea around my why I felt so sympathetic for the Defence Force here, and I was thinking about people on a, you know, defence personnel on a submarine. Stuck on a submarine, mm-hmm. you're potentially underwater for a month or two at a time if it's in a, you know, one of those really submarines fitted out for that sort of thing. Now, yeah. You might start off as a submariner and you might end up contracting some sort of disease, like celiac disease, for example, where you're completely intolerant to gluten and you're going to have major issues. Mm. Now, they might, the Defence Force would be able to say, you know what, in a submarine environment, we can't have two kitchens keeping gluten free from one part. We can't possibly feed you and everybody else. As operational matter, this just isn't going to work. Not your fault. You can have an honourable discharge if you like, or we can find a desk job for you on land or some other thing, but mm-hmm. you can't be a submariner anymore. And I think
yeah.
people would say, fair enough. But
yeah, agreed.
If you're the submariner and you just say, well, you know what, I choose now that I should be gluten-free, just not happy having gluten, and I'd like my meals prepared separately, well, you know, the Defence Force could say the same thing. Well, they'd say, well, no, they wouldn't say the same thing. They'd say, well, you can take it or leave it. Like, that's what the job's always been. That's what you should have expected. If you didn't like it, you shouldn't have signed up for it. And you can have a dishonourable discharge if you don't like it, if you're going to leave. But
yeah.
that's your choice to do that. It's not circumstance foisted upon you. And, you know, that's how I see that with this fellow, that he has decided to take on an ideology, and if that doesn't fit with what he's doing, then quit and go and become self-employed, a job mowing lawns where you can stop for five times and do your prayers or whatever. Like, I just have some sympathy.
That's the thing that I find absurd about the whole thing, is you've got this situation where what are the requirements of Ramadan? You're just not supposed to eat during the day and that sort of
yeah.
stuff. And, you know, it's just a ridiculous suggestion that any army can down tools and pray five times
yes.
a day.
So
it's ridiculous.
Yeah. I've got a lot of sympathy for the Australian Defence Force there. Interestingly, how many Muslims... Here's another quiz for you, Scott. How many Muslims do you reckon there are among the... there's 57,000 permanent members of the Australian Defence Force. How many Muslims in that 57,000?
Well, there's 2% of the population, so 2%.
Oh, okay. I've got a calculator here. 0.02 times 57. Yeah. So that would be 1,140.
Yeah.
It's...
And how many are there?
Well, it's 102.
102, yeah.
So, that surprised me it was that many, actually. I just didn't think that would be that many. But there you go, folks, 102 Muslims amongst the 57,000. And, in fact, the Australian Navy has recently introduced special Islamic dress for female officers, halal food options, really? And has appointed a Muslim chaplain.
Well, okay.
Didn't know that, did you?
No, I didn't know that, you know.
Now, there's been... the 12th man sent us through some articles, and
he did.
One of them was more cartoon violence, this time in India.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
What's going on there is that there's a newspaper that had a... an article which had a piggy bank in it, a picture of a piggy bank, and that's set the local Muslim population rank.
Yep.
And they have gone and smashed up the offices of the place of the newspaper article, which I find bizarre. But anyway,
in about five different locations of that newspaper as well, like they've gone to several of their offices and trashed them.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, religious extremism by Muslims over cartoons.
Well, cartoons of a piggy bank.
Mm.
Yeah, which is just bizarre. But anyway, that's, I don't know whether or not it's related to the objection they have to pork or not, but...
Yeah. And he also sent us one about New Zealand families which are on welfare.
Yeah.
And what was the story there?
Well, the campaign is... Its campaigns have called for an end to taxpayers subsidising families which tithe. So what it is that because, you know, if you give 10% of your income to the church and that sort of stuff, you can then get a tax deduction for that. So the argument is that this is because people donate money to a charity, they're entitled to claim a 33.33% tax rebate on their donations if they had taxable income in the year they donated. So what you do is you hand over 10% of your income and then you get 33 1/3 cents back of that income from the tax office or the Inland Revenue Department, I believe it's called, across the creek. It's just an interesting article. There's a fair bit in there that read into it, but the part that I found most interesting was from Chris Bethwaite, National Administrator of the Elm Church in New Zealand, said, as far as the benefit to the taxpayer goes, a tax credit goes back to the individual that gives. The individual gets the benefit and the individual is the taxpayer. They're receiving a tax credit for their generosity. So, you know, I mean, he's just... it's just the usual sort of argument saying that it's not the government's giving money, it's the individual that's giving money. Well, it's not. It's, you know, it's the government that's going about this. Anyway, it's an interesting article.
Yep.
So I did quite like that one, and I must thank the 12th man for sending that through.
So Scott, that's all of the articles I had, and the only other thing, I think next week, with a bit of luck, we will talk about... there's a bit of an internal discussion in the secular party, Scott, about the approach that the party... can or should take in arguing about religion. And my view is that we should be prepared to say that religions are harmful in many ways, and therefore we should be against religion for these reasons. And the other view within the party is that we should simply be asking for secular laws and we shouldn't be commenting one way or another as to the goodness or badness of religions or any particular religion. And I think the problem is we have this title of the secular party and people think that means we've got to be neutral about religion. And as people might have guessed from the last 23 episodes, I'm far from neutral, and I don't think we should be neutral. So anyway...
Look, I tend to fall in the neutral camp more so than anything else.
Yeah, so that's a discussion that we've got to have internally, I think, about just how far we can go in criticising religions and... Yeah, so maybe some news over the next few weeks as to whether that stays the same or whether there's a change of status there. So stay tuned for that. And, of course, people, if you have any interesting articles you've come across, please send them through to us. In terms of Facebook likes, we'd really like some more because that would help. And
we haven't done too badly, actually, in the last little while.
Yeah, and... On the website is a link which describes how to like us on iTunes or how to leave a review. So if you can follow the instructions on that and leave a positive review about us, that would be great. And if you want to leave a negative review, then just pretend you didn't hear what I've just said. And Scott, I think well, welcome back, and I reckon
very
good.
It's glad to be
back. And we'll no doubt talk during the week. And folks, we will catch up with you next week. But for the moment, it's goodbye for now.
And goodbye from me too. Okay, goodbye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.